Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're doing okay this week. Thank you so much to those who came to the live show at the BFI on Saturday. It was so wonderful to be in that room and get together and just talk about death in a non-deeply depressing way, hopefully. If you did miss out, don't worry. We have another live show coming up on November the 16th at the Dulwich Picture Gallery, where I'll be joined by Jeff Lloyd, Stevie Martin and Sophie Duker to have some more cheery chats about death. Head to the Dulwich Picture Gallery website for tickets. This week I'm talking to writer Kim Sherwood. Kim's debut novel, Testament, won the 2016 Bath Novel Award and is loosely based on her own experience of grief after her grandfather, the actor George Baker, died. It's a really incredible book. I would genuinely recommend it. It tackles a lot of other subjects other than grief, including World War II, the Holocaust, memory, you know, huge big topics, but it's beautifully written and a genuinely incredible first novel. Kim came in to talk to me about her grandfather, who died in 2011. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm joined today by writer Kim Sherwood. Hello.
Hello.
Kim, I have a confession. I'm really, really tired today.
Me too.
Why I'm tired is entirely your fault.
Oh, no.
I was up reading your amazing book, Testament. When did it come out? It's been out a while.
July 12th.
I've been wondering. I was like, is it available to buy? I'm a bit overall because I'm going to be honest. Okay, first, this is my first point to you. Bit heavy for the tube carrying wise. It's a big book.
Yes, that's fair. I have to carry it to all of my events. Yeah. And I have been a bit like, couldn't I have edited more? It could be lighter.
I mean, but you know what? Some books, it's worth it, you know? Like, I remember carrying that giant Harry Potter around.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, you know what? This is worth it. It is worth it, but definitely it's not. I think because so many books are so light these days, listeners, don't be put off. It's not like a tome. But I just want to say, like, fucking hell, it's amazing.
Thank you.
It's such a good book.
Thank you.
As someone who does a podcast on grief, I tend to try and avoid reading.
I'd imagine.
About sad things. And you wouldn't believe my bedside table at the moment has Life After Death, The Day That Went Missing, Learning to Die. Like, it's, and so when Testament got added, I was like, oh gosh. Like, but it's, I will use the phrase fucking good.
Thank you so much.
It's so good.
Really kind. Thank you.
Well, I know, what else can you say? It's awkward. So just briefly, what is it about? Just so people know why I'm going about it. Why is it? It might make you initially, like this podcast, initially think, do I really want to read about that?
Mm. Yeah. So it's about the impact of the Holocaust on three generations of a family. Mm. It opens with a grandfather dying. And it's really about the relationship between the grandfather and the granddaughter. So he's called Joseph Silk. He's an artist. And he's sort of one of Britain's most eminent abstract painters in the novel. He has this kind of secret past that he's kept hidden. He's a Holocaust survivor, but he's always refused to talk about it. Mm. And when he dies, his granddaughter Eva discovers a witness testimony that he gave in 1945, which tells the story of what happened to him and his family. And she then has to make the decision of whether or not to let the Jewish Museum in Berlin make it public and therefore undermine the reconstructed identity that he spent all of his life trying to make, in which he wasn't a Holocaust survivor, he was Joseph Silk and a painter, and could put that behind him.
Yeah. You've had to give that answer a lot. It was really good. I was like, thank you. Yeah, that is a good one. I wouldn't have gone there. That's good. It's such a good, but what I found interesting as someone who, like, yeah, you know, did know some of that history. I didn't know much about Hungary at all. I knew lots about Poland and Germany. Mm. So I think that's mainly what's taught in schools.
Yeah.
But I had no idea about the Hungarian Jewish situation and what had happened there. And yeah, I found that like opening another door, being like, oh, and also being like, oh no, oh God, what's in here?
Yes, this is
awful.
That was what a lot of my research was like for the novel, opening another door and going, it just gets worse.
Yeah.
It just keeps getting worse. And I didn't think it could.
I know you don't think it could. Mm. And it's not to say it's not like Hungary was worse than Poland. It's just another bit of the story, another branch that you're like, oh, and that was also
And quite a different branch as well, I think, because in some ways the Holocaust in Hungary was unique because they had the Hungarian Forced Labour Service, which was essentially slavery in a mobile way, as strange as that sounds. So people who were deemed undesirable, Jewish people, communist people, and so on, were digging trenches or working in mines or being moved from place to place for years before we really think of the camps.
Wow.
So there was this system in Hungary, this kind of institutionalized anti-Semitism for a long time. I mean, the first anti-Semitic law was passed in Hungary in 1920, and that was the first anti-Semitic law in Europe in the 20th century.
Oh, Hungary, it doesn't look good on the old Tinder profile, does it? Like, first anti-Semitic law in Europe.
Yes, got there first.
Yeah.
Sorry, Germany.
Yeah. But the other thing I found so interesting about it, and I love history anyway, is the reminder of how messy history is, and the reminder that Hungary and Austria and Germany and France and England are so connected in a way that we act like we're not. The way you're like, they're a separate country. And I thought it was so incredible the way that people were just walking through borders and travelling and talk, and they keep talking about life before the war and how the freedom of everyone being... And I think it's really easy in England, because we are an island, I do think the physical psychology makes us go, oh, it must be like... They must be like us over there. Like, it's like, no.
Yeah.
It's there's a... When you're up against another country, there's a difference. Same with us, with Scotland and Wales. We wouldn't,
absolutely,
you know.
Absolutely. And I think also with the Jewish diaspora and the movement that's involved in that, it is such a matter of shared culture.
Yeah.
And I often think of the end of World War II as the kind of world map being shaken, because then you have people moving to places as refugees that they never would have ended up in. So my family moved from Hungary and ended up in Australia. You know, that was on nobody's minds before the Holocaust. And then came to England. So you just have these movements, which I find really fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's that thing again of, it's so easy. I just realised earlier it sounded like I was saying, and quite right, we think of ourselves an island. I don't think that, in case you... It's pretty obvious which way I voted. Because I think it's so easy to I don't know, I just think to make history seem... Oh, that was ages ago.
Absolutely.
Like... To forget how connected World War II is to Brexit.
Yes. Oh my God. Absolutely. Like, and when you looked just recently, the UKIP members invading Bookmark's bookshop. There's just so many echoes today of the 1930s and 40s, and I think they are directly related.
And it's always about fear and not understanding. Yeah. Like, it's just so that's why, again, I found the book that, you know, that classically great history novel where you're like, oh, that happened in the past, but it's happening now. Oh my God. Yeah, it was amazing. So, speaking of your family, in case people think we're doing like a front row on each other. It's not that, even though the book is amazing. Who are we remembering today?
So my grandfather's death was really the beginning of the novel in many ways. I was very fortunate to be very close with him all of my life. He was very much a father figure to me, really. And he'd been ill for over a year before he died, so I had warning, I still, I was shocked by grief. I think I was in a state of shock, you know, as if I hadn't had warning. But maybe there's no warning you can have, really.
So when did he die? How many years ago?
So he died in 2011.
Oh, okay.
And it was a really strange time because my granny Louie, his wife, his third wife, passed away the summer of 2011. And then he passed away in the autumn, so very quickly after her.
Wow.
And then my aunt became very ill. Luckily, she was okay. And then I was diagnosed with arthritis. So it was this strange, very intense few months where my whole sense of self and life changed in ways that I hadn't, although, as I said, I had warning with him being ill, in ways I hadn't really anticipated fully.
I think when you even said that about the map in Europe being shaped, like, that's to me how I always describe grief, as someone's done the tablecloth trick.
Yes, absolutely.
So you're like, everything is the same, but everything's moved like an inch.
Yes, yes. And people would look at it and say, oh, but your life's still the same. Yeah. And you're thinking, but
can't you see? The glass was not there and I did not move it.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
How is that okay?
Exactly.
Yeah. So what did he die of? Was it just old age or?
Yeah, so, oh God, he was an ox of a man. It took so much to bring him down. He's very, very big, 6'4".
Wow.
And very broad. And he had multiple strokes across the year. I want to say, I think it was nearly 10.
Wow.
And he just kept recovering. Although he was telling us, I want to die, just let me go.
Oh,
and then he'd recover again. I would say, George, just stop getting better.
We are not doing this to annoy you.
Yeah. And he lost he lost movement, he lost speech. It was one really strange thing was that he grew up in Bulgaria.
Right.
His family are British, but his father was a British politician in Bulgaria. So he was born there. And kind of raised by house staff. So he spent his younger years talking Bulgarian, really.
Wow.
Then they had to flee Bulgaria as the Nazis came. He was in Paris the night before it fell to the Nazis. And he was, I think, 12 years old. His mother thought it would be a good idea to take him to the Moulin Rouge because she thought it won't be there anymore. So 12 years old, he goes to see, you know, the women dancing in the Moulin Rouge.
Oh my God.
And then arrives in England, and he was responsible for his whole family.
That is a. I mean, I'm not gonna judge her. It was in time of war, but that was a bold choice,
absolutely.
Mama.
She was a bold lady. He had to do quite a lot of taking care because that was her idea of, you know, solid parenting.
So then they came to England.
And he had a really thick Bulgarian accent at the school because of the time. They thought he was stupid. Because he had an accent.
Yeah.
So then when he became ill and his strokes affected the speech centre in his brain, he started to speak in these sort of very poetic metaphors. You know, he'd say, when he could still speak properly, he'd say to you, oh, I'm on the ramparts, when you'd say, how are you?
Wow.
So it was still kind of making sense. And then he started to speak what sounded to us like made-up words we didn't really know. And a nurse said to us, so, you know, how long was he in Bulgaria for? Did he come here recently?
Oh, my God.
What do you mean? And she said, he's speaking fluent Bulgarian, which, as far as we knew, he couldn't do anymore because he hadn't done it since he was a child. So it just ignited that bit in his brain. This kind of past came back.
I find that so crazy.
Isn't that amazing?
That's so insane.
Yeah.
Did you know what he was saying? Did she tell you?
Well, luckily she was there to sort of translate for us.
Wow.
And it was very strange because he was, in my life, this very towering figure.
Yeah.
Very big, huge personality, very charming, very entertaining, always sort of throwing a party, always at the head of the table.
Yeah.
And then he was suddenly in this bed that he couldn't get out of.
Yeah.
And he couldn't really speak. And I just sit there reading him his favourite poetry and trying to talk to him, keep him company, but he couldn't communicate anymore. And he was such a communicator, he was an actor. And so his whole life was about communication and about performance, and then he couldn't really do either anymore. But he was so gracious during it. That was something that really struck me, that he was being absolutely reduced and remained so gracious to everybody around him when it must have been sending him mad.
God, yeah. It's so weird, isn't it? I remember someone saying to me, they were asking me about when my dad was dying, and they said, they were referring to when they had seen their dad and said, oh, like, you know, to see like an old man or something. And I was like, well, because my dad was 44, like, I never had like, oh, they're old.
Yeah.
But when he was sick in the bed, the thing that I said, like, again, big personality, I just never seen him that still.
Yes.
And that's what really shook me. I was like, what's that? I was like, oh, he's not moving. Yes. Like, he just, like,
that animation.
And animation. Yes. And be around the room and, like, you know, you just be like, oh, God, what's he doing? He's not sitting. Like, is he going to sit down? Is he going to go? Like, just this energy about everything. And to just see someone lying there is very, like, yeah, I think it depends what your, what's the word? Like, what your innate personality is before you get sick.
Yes.
Like, if it is big and bold and loud. It's the quiet that's suddenly like, oh my God, like, that's how you know it's not great.
Yeah,
exactly. So were you with him when he died?
I wasn't there. My mum was there. My mum was holding his hand.
And is that her mum? Is that her dad? Right,
yeah. Okay, yeah. And my auntie Sarah, she was there as well. So they sat with him. I just begun my MA.
Right.
So I was university. It was a week in.
And, oh, God.
It was very peculiar because I didn't, you know, it was all new people around me. And so nobody really knew me or knew what my relationship with him was.
Yeah.
So it was also the weekend I was having my birthday party. And you know, when you're sort of in the immediacy of a shock like that, you just, well, I just sort of carried on.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
So I still had the party.
Yeah, of course, because so, your feet are just walking in front of each other.
Yeah, yeah, and I'd had just invited everybody. So I thought, okay, well, I'll just do that then. And all these strangers came to my house first week, and it was supposed to be a sort of, let's all get to know each other party. Yeah. And I remember this point about 2 a.m, dancing to Twist and Shout, and just feeling like I was leaving my body, and I could see myself dancing, and I was just floating above myself thinking, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And it's really odd because we're a very big party family, love throwing parties, and that's, I've grown up with that, and grown up with the, you know, I'll host everybody, and I'll, you know, make sure everyone's having a brilliant time and do the playlist and all of that stuff. And then from that moment onwards, for a long, long time, I didn't like parties anymore, and I didn't like hosting, and I didn't want people to come over, even though George, my grandfather, that had been so much part of his life. But I think just in that moment of dancing and realizing I shouldn't be doing this, you know,
I think it's so hard because I think we're so harsh on ourselves of what the correct reaction is.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, especially like, I was 15, so I spent a lot of time at parties thinking,
yeah,
what are you doing?
Yeah.
And I know exactly what you mean when you are, I used to be almost standing beside myself. Yes, that's how I felt.
Exactly that.
I was like next to myself going, what's that girl next to me?
Yes,
going?
Yes.
And I'd be like, that's you.
Yeah, like there's a sort of shadow version of yourself that people are interacting with. And
oh my God.
Can't people tell?
Yeah.
And then I remember I went into class the next day and said to people, oh, well, my grandfather's passed away. And somebody said to me, oh God, you have to go to a funeral, how boring.
And fuck you. You know, yeah, exactly. That's always like, what I say when people say, fuck you, you don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
What is wrong with, what?
Yeah, and I was thinking, well, you know, I don't know what's going on in your life. That's, fine.
If that's a much that's kinder response. Version, Kim. That's why you're a nice person, I'm a comedian, because I go, fuck you.
But yeah, fuck you was how I was feeling. And it was exactly what you were saying about your feet just keep walking. I stayed on and I did the MA, and in retrospect I wish I had stopped.
Wow.
Although my novel did begin there, and I'm glad for that, it was very difficult to engage with those around me and to engage with what I was supposed to be doing while feeling like I was I felt like I was losing my mind, to be honest.
And it
was very hard to articulate to people around me. I was really far away from my family as well. I was studying at UEA in Norwich, and my family were in Devon, so opposite sides of the country.
And then you've lost your route. You've lost your, you know, the people who keep you on the ground and go, it's all right.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, exactly. And I felt very, like my, as you were saying, the reality had so shifted. And because he was an actor, you know, in the days afterwards, there he was on the radio, and there he was on newspapers, and there he was on the news, and people were writing their sort of obituaries or their memory pieces, or, and it felt a bit like they were kind of taking him away from me. I remember as well, there was one thing, although again, like, they didn't mean it in a harmful way at all, but I saw in the newspaper that there was a horse running in a race called Baker. My actor's my grandfather's name's George Baker. And the person writing about the sports that weekend did a joke, you know, there's Baker's running this weekend, but of course George Baker just died, so, you know, might not go that well, or something like that. And I remember just feeling like, God, it, because he was public property to an extent,
yeah.
I understand why you feel you can make that joke.
But ow.
But ow.
Yeah. Like, sure, great copy, but ow, that hurts.
Yeah.
We did an episode with Amy Hoggart, whose dad was Simon Hoggart, who was, you know, broadcaster and journalist and comedian. And she said, I mean, obviously there's a world I do not understand. And she said that, like, yeah, you know, when they were just sort of having those first couple of days, she turned on the radio and they were playing old clips of him and on the news quiz. And I was like, I can't imagine how bizarre that must be to not be in control of the memory.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
I think that's really interesting because I am not in control of some of my memories because I'm, as we say, analogue griever. So 1998 is like, you know, I have photos that are difficult to find.
Right.
So if I want to torture myself, it's an effort.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Amy said, she can just YouTube her dad.
Yeah.
Just type it in.
Yeah.
So I think that's such a, like you said, the idea of somebody not quite being yours.
Yes.
I think you know that in, like, I think, inverted commas, normal people. like, you know that your dad or your grandfather's like, you know, when people start telling you at funerals, they'll tell you stuff and you're like, oh, that's not the person I knew.
It's just,
but you must, it must be so magnified that, like, there was another version of them.
Yeah, I remember at a, so we had the funeral itself, which was actually wonderful. It was a brilliant party, which was very fitting for him. And then we had a memorial, kind of actor's memorial. And an actor came up to me and said to me, so how are you connected to George?
Oh my God.
And I just felt this huge surge of anger. He was my grandfather. I just went, he was mine. What are you, you know,
how are you doing? How are you connected to
him?
Yeah, yeah. Why are you here?
Exactly. And I remember my uncle, telling my uncle, you know, this has just happened. And I felt really angry. And him saying to me, instead of laughing, oh, well, play up and play the game. And just feeling like, I don't want to.
No.
I don't have the energy to play.
I know.
I just want to be left alone.
I think also that playing the game, I'm really bad at playing the game.
Mm.
Like, as soon as I sense the game, I'm like, I'm not fucking playing.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Oh, is that what you're all doing? I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
So, what's the word? Contrarian, obtuse, and deeply unhelpful in many situations. But I think there has to be... Do you know, I wonder if it's about being vulnerable, because if... you have to be quite tough to be like, sure, let's play the game for this this time. And you know, like, that's quite hard when you're like, I don't feel like I have the strength to pretend to be a person right now. Like,
yes, you know. Exactly. And because as well, he was so tied into my sense of myself as a person.
Yeah.
Because he was he was a brilliant grandfather, and I think he put a lot of energy into it. I think there were some things about his younger years and maybe his parenting that he would have changed.
Mm.
And I think he worked on that with his grandkids.
Yeah.
So we were very fortunate in that. So he loved poetry. He loved literature. And for me, I was incredibly bored at school. I was always frustrated at school. I was always the person who sort of finished first and then was told to wait while other people, you know, got on with it. Which was fair enough from my teacher's perspective, you know.
But
for me, it was deeply maddening. And he was always wanting to introduce me to new poetry and expand what I was reading and kind of provide for me in a way what school wasn't providing for me. I remember there was one for A-level, English language A-level. The coursework was to write a textbook, and it was supposed to show that you could
God,
write.
I'm already.
I know, right?
A textbook, great, thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So it's the show that you could do instructional writing.
Okay.
So I decided that what I would do would be to write a textbook, so the history of English literature across the world. This is how I made life difficult for myself
nice
at the time.
Nice and easy, yeah, sure. That'll take me 5 minutes, I can do that. You don't want to write how to set up a table then?
Yeah.
If someone else is doing just
a table. I think that was what they wanted.
Yep.
No, I remember.
I got this, guys, I got this. I got something better, don't worry.
Yeah, trust me, it'll be really fascinating. So... I was staying the weekend at George's house, and I said to him, oh, I'm thinking of writing maybe about how, you know, assimilation literature, maybe how that worked in French and English colonies, and, you know, had all these different ideas. He was nodding away. And then he said, well, darling, the thing is, you don't want to be facetious. I remember thinking, I don't know what facetious means, but I'll agree.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to be facetious.
No, I don't. Yeah. Okay, sure.
And he said, right, so we're going to sit down, we're going to do it properly. okay. So he had the most amazing book collection. He was entirely self-educated because at school they had thought that he was unintelligent and he'd left very young. Entirely self-educated. We sat down with all of his poetry books, all, you know, his huge novel collection, and he just told me the history of literature from beginning to end.
Wow.
And it was just phenomenal. And so his encouragement and his belief in me as a writer was so bound up with my identity that then when he... I was about to say when he left, when he wasn't there anymore. It was like this fundamental crack down the middle of me, because he was somebody, and it was really crucial that it was a man, because he was one of the few men in my life when I was growing up. He was a man who saw me for me and thought I didn't need to change or do anything differently. I wasn't... I remember actually that English language A-level teacher, in a note from her to another teacher, which crossed my path and shouldn't have. And it said, Kim Sherwood's being difficult again, because I was doing this project. But he didn't think I was difficult, and he didn't think I was wrong in any way, in any part of me. And that was, as a teenager, when you think you're wrong in so many ways.
Yeah.
That was so fundamental.
God, yeah, and to not be treated like you said, I know exactly, we sound quite similar at school. It was like I was consciously making a problem, rather than like, no, I thought this would be more interesting.
Yeah, yeah, I'm just trying to learn.
Yeah, I'm just trying to learn. But what you, I think it's taken me ages to realise as an adult, is what you're saying to an, as a teenager you're saying to another adult is, but what you've said is boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you don't, you're like, yeah, but I thought you knew that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, obviously it's boring, right? And you're like, they thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
But what you've proved
And they're busy and stressed and they're like, and can't you just be like everyone else?
Yeah, you've said it's boring, which they know. Somewhere they know that. Mm. And not only have you said it's boring, you produce something more interesting. Mm. So now everyone in the class thinks it boring. So your one move has, and it is, you go, you didn't have to do that. You're like, but as a teenager, you're like, I don't know any other way.
Yes.
I wish, trust me, wish I could be like Sarah Guy over there doing every single thing she's supposed to do.
Yeah.
And so
beautifully. Or not care and just not do the, not want to learn. But I just, you know, I was desperate to get to university in many ways because I thought there would be, you know, people who love learning. It turned out differently, but
yeah.
in some ways. But he was just so supportive always. And also very much around, so I've always had short hair. And I've always, you know, when I was younger, certainly looked like a boy. Or like a tiny monk at times because I shaved my head. And lots of people thought I was a boy. And they mistake me for a boy. And then when it turned out I wasn't, people would sometimes throw rocks at me at once. So there was that going on at the same time. Yeah. Great fun. Yeah. Great fun. And again, you could say making life difficult for myself. Yeah, but I thought, why shouldn't I be able to have short hair? Why does it have to be and dress like a boy, whatever that means? Why does it have to be a problem to anybody? And George, who was this very sort of charming, debonair man who'd had sort of quite the love life in his time and was very glamorous in my eyes in many ways, he would always say, but you're so beautiful, darling. Don't worry about any of that. And, you know, with your short hair and wearing your Arsenal kit, you're so beautiful. It doesn't matter. And that meant so much to me.
Yeah.
Again, to have because I've got, I should say, a brilliant mum
who
let me shave my head when I wanted to and let me, you know, write textbooks about the history of English literature when I wanted to. But I didn't really have many men in my life.
Yeah.
So he was that male figure who was saying to me, you are more than good enough just the way you are. And then to lose that, I was bereft of that.
Mm. It's really interesting. You made me think about so many things. My dad used to say to me almost every day that he loved me and that he was proud of me. And he used to say things like brain the size of a planet. Was just like one of his things. Brain the size of a planet. Wait, and he used to click his fingers at me. Where are you going? And I had to say Cambridge. I didn't even know what Cambridge was. FYI, I did not go to Cambridge because I think I did it to piss him off. But like, very, like when I say, it's funny because like when I try and describe that we had a difficult relationship or like he was difficult, it was not about... Like there was, you know, it wasn't as simple as like, oh, he didn't tell me he loved me. It's like, no. Like almost every day, to the point it was boring. Like the relationship was, I'd roll my eyes and be like, oh yeah, fine. He's like, yeah, I'm so proud of you. I'd be like, yeah, I know. Mm. You tell me every day. Because I, you know, you don't know how to react.
Yeah.
And I think I found, what you're saying is really, I find really resonating because when he died, something in me was like, it's really hard to describe. It was like, oh, was he lying?
Mm.
Because
he's not here to say it.
He's not here to say it. And even though I can see what he was trying to do, was like, I'm being so encouraging. But I was like, but you did it every day and you made it like part of my breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do it, I don't know how to do it.
Yes.
You didn't sort of encourage me to do it. Mm. You just told me like that was the truth.
Yes.
So you're the God, you're the sun in this world that tells me the truth every day.
Yes.
But when you've gone, I don't know how to do it.
And left in darkness.
Yeah. And I found that really, there was part of me that was so... Again, grief's so complicated, but like, I was angry for very many reasons.
Mm.
But I was so angry that he wasn't there
saying
nice things anymore.
Yes.
Because it was like, you took something that, but then it takes years to go, but I'm glad I had that.
Yeah.
But at the time, it just feels like, well, what do I,
yeah
like you said, who am I if you're not telling me who I am?
Yes, and who's left in a way to tell me?
Yeah.
And it's strange, now the novel's come out, I always imagined that when I wrote my first novel, you know, I'd take it to him and I'd say, look, you were right, I could do it.
Yeah.
And I did do it. And this one, I wrote because of him, but I can't give to him. And that's very difficult to have to logically accept.
Mm.
No, he's not going to put his arms around me and say, oh, well done, darling, really proud of you. That's not going to happen.
And do you think there's a part of you that's why you did that book? Like, you're almost still... Like, I'm still looking for him to say, well done.
Mm.
So it's like, I'm still doing things that I think, oh, he would have... Yeah, that would have been good.
And I have, I think, part of my identity is based around, George would have approved.
Yeah.
So it's okay, in a way, it gives me permission to do something.
Like,
I always think about, for his 75th birthday, we were celebrating at the Groucho or the Garrick Club... Can't remember which, but it's sort of
the
actors' club.
A cool club.
Yeah, the actors' club. But it's an all-male club.
Right.
And they have one room that they'll let women in.
Welcome to 21st century, guys.
So George, great lover of women in his life, three wives and many others besides, and five daughters and granddaughters. He was, you know, he wanted to have it in his club where his friends were, but he said, okay, I'll have it in the women's room. And the wine was flowing, lots of celebration. And on the way in, I'd been told, you can be in this room, but you can't go up the main staircase. That's the male staircase. And there's a staircase around the back for women if you need to go upstairs.
Trade entrance.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh my God.
So I waited to the point in the evening where everybody had sort of drunk enough fine wine not to notice me sneak away. And I thought, I'm going to go up the main staircase.
Yeah, fuck those guys.
Yeah. So I was going up the staircase, sort of, you know, step by step, thinking, what wonders wait for me at the top?
Yeah,
there's got to be something good, or why are they keeping me from the staircase? And then this sort of man dressed like a butler came down and sort of coughed politely and said, ma'am, you're not supposed to be here. This is the male-only staircase. So I prepared my sort of, oh, sorry, I didn't realise. And then from behind me, my grandfather's voice bellowing, my granddaughter can do whatever the fuck she likes. And I turned around and he was leaning against the banister at the bottom. He'd been watching me do it. And I often think about that when I'm nervous or I'm not sure, can I do this? Do I have this in me? I overthink, my granddaughter can do whatever the fuck she likes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What an amazing... thing to shout.
Brilliant. I felt slightly sorry for the butler man.
Yeah, sure.
Who looked terrified.
Yeah, it's like, it's just my job. Yeah, but check your rules, buddy.
Yeah, exactly.
What system are you carrying on? This is how the patriarchy survives. That's amazing. God.
Yeah.
What an amazing war cry to have in your head.
Mm. Yeah, and it has really stayed with me. And I feel like he's been with me through this publishing process. Little odd moments have occurred.
Really?
So when I won the Bath Novel Award in 2016, the judge was Sue Armstrong, who became my agent. And she's at the Conville & Walsh agency, which is run by Claire Conville, whose father used to run the open-air theatre in Regent's Park, where George used to act, and where my mum worked in catering, and everybody I know worked in catering. So as a child, I'd run around there.
Yeah.
So... my mum and Claire used to work together on the bar when they were like 16.
Wow.
So that was funny to have. So David Conwell, Claire's father, was a really good friend of George, was visiting him in the hospital at the end. So when I joined them, I felt almost like I had George's permission.
Yeah,
And then when I signed my book deal with River Run, there was this really strange moment. We were in the kind of pitch meeting where they were telling me what their vision for the book would be. And one of the editors said to me, oh, by the way, we're working on a kind of memoir at the moment. And in this book, the writer notes that George Baker lent him a cookery book once that set him off on cooking and he never gave it back. And he's been meaning to and wonders if he could give it to the family. And is George Baker your grandfather? Yes. So, yeah, sure, oh I'll take God. That book and give it to my mum. So it's just this weird moment. I felt like George was... He used to bang on the table very emphatically to make points. I felt like he was banging on the table going, sign with these people, Kim. Going, okay, George, I will.
Also, get me my bloody book
yes,
back.
Exactly.
About bloody time.
It's like for decades now.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, I know... God, that's nice when you have those moments. Mm. Especially with creative stuff, when I think, because so much creative stuff is very terrifying.
Yeah.
And there's not a right and wrong. It's just like, there's only the consequences of this choice.
Yes, and people always say, go with your gut.
Oh my God, what the fuck? What's like, my gut saying?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, my gut's in turmoil. What do you want from me?
Yeah, like I'm literally, guys, it's full on anxiety.
Yes, yes.
My gut is saying, you're probably going to make the wrong decision.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh God,
it's not trained.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So when you were writing this book, I mean, how much is the grandfather character based on your, is it kind of?
So there are aspects of him that I have liberally stolen from George's life.
Right.
There are aspects of him that are very different, of course. But certainly the, so Silk, the grandfather character in the book, is very charming. Mm. He's a great storyteller. He very much commands the room. And he is very loving and at points that can get him into trouble.
Yeah.
So my granddad, I don't think would have minded me saying this. He wrote about it in his memoir. He was sort of having affairs with Brigitte Bardot, and you know, he was getting himself into trouble a lot as a younger man. And I thought about that a lot, because I thought about how my love for George was very uncomplicated and straightforward and unconditional. And so was his for me. But I knew that there were things that he'd done in his life that hurt people. I also loved straightforwardly and absolutely. And particularly some of the women in his life. And so that's very hard to balance.
Yeah.
And of course, good people behave badly.
Yeah.
It's just, people aren't black and white, simple one way or another. But I thought a lot about that, about how can I almost balance my all-encompassing, unconditional love with actually did some things that, which he regretted and which are to be regretted.
And did you, when you were writing it, and I guess you were still grieving, like, how did you, I get asked this a lot of, like, oh, you know, how do you, you're talking about your dad and he's not, like, how did you balance it in your head? Like, did you feel, was there a part of you thinking, should I be writing? Like, did you feel guilty? Or
there were a couple of things where I wrote them and then read over them, realised where they'd come from, and would say to my mum, is this okay?
Yeah.
That I've put, you know, no one will ever know that this particular aspect but is from him. Know, but, yeah. But yeah, is it okay? And my mum's very creative herself, and I think was always aware that I was articulating my love for him, my relationship with him, the loss of him. It was very, that there were so many strands to what I was doing, and however it came out, in a way that had to be okay.
Yeah.
Not that you, I have a writer friend who says you have to crucify your family for art.
Oh, God.
Which I feel is...
Is it a man?
A bit extreme, yes.
Mm.
Yes, indeed.
Mm. I just... that any of this idea that an artist has to be tortured, that everything has to be destroyed, I just think... And I don't... Oh, people get annoyed with me saying this, but it's like, we do live in a patriarchy. We do live in a world where men have written a lot of history. And okay, hashtag not all men, I'm with you. But the idea of... the idea of art meaning... destroying, I think,
yes.
is an interesting,
yes.
An old-fashioned idea.
And
actually,
how much of an excuse is it that you've destroyed something, and then so then it's handy that you can say it was for your art?
Exactly,
if you look at,
yeah.
Have you seen Nanette?
I was just about to bring that up.
Yeah, I loved her section on Picasso.
It was incredible,
amazing, and it's so.
If you haven't seen it, that is Hannah Gadsby's stand-up special on Netflix, which is kind of deconstructs every single, you know, art for art's sake bullshit that comes from.
And it really encapsulated for me what I found troubling about the Picasso exhibition at the Tate, where they were talking about his leaving his wife and affairs with younger women and getting women pregnant and leaving them. And it's called, the exhibition has the word tragedy in the title, and it just made me think, tragedy for who?
Yeah.
Because you're framing it like it was his tragedy, but he was effectively destroying these people's lives, and I'm sure it was difficult for him too, but nobody was making him.
Yeah.
And we're kind of celebrating it.
Yeah, we're celebrating it because, like, as Hannah says, that you get the art at the end.
Yes, yes.
Rather than thinking about, as people have raised so much, you don't get the art of those women that were destroyed
by
him.
No, or their voices.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of that kind of destructive behaviour, the excuse is, oh, well, it's all part of my process.
Mm.
Well, no, it's part of you treating other people as if they're not human.
Yeah.
Your process is something else. And if the two are entangled, let's talk about that. But that's a shame.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, because I have it with this show as well, of like, I can only tell my side of the story.
Mm.
But of course, we all know, as anyone who does anything creative, you know you could crucify people or not.
Mm. Yes.
And I think,
yes,
like, we
choice.
All know that sentence before you say something in your head of thinking, you know, I mean, I could literally say what actually happened here, but that wouldn't be very fair to X, Y, and Z who are still living.
Yes.
So I think you can definitely, like, I've had, who was it? I can't remember, somebody was a bit funny about something I wrote about my dad recently. Mm. And I was like, look, that's the perspective of a daughter on his life. You might have a very different perspective of, you know, of him as a friend. Sure.
Yes.
And I would never challenge you on that. I'd challenge you, and like, if you said how he was as a dad,
yes.
he wasn't your dad.
Yes.
And
yes.
it's a very unique perspective that I have.
Absolutely.
So I think, like, yeah, it's hard, because the endless thing when you use grief in your art is that you're having a conversation with someone who's not there.
Yes.
So everyone can fill in the blanks. I'm filling in the blanks for my dad, and then
yes.
other people can be like, well, we disagree. And it's just the one person in the room who... And people are so fucking fickle. We can all think, oh, he would have done this.
Yeah.
Who knows, on the fucking day, he might have gone, no, actually, I don't care. Like,
yes. And that's what I was trying to think about as well with the character of Silk. Because he's this eminent artist, everybody around him is trying to analyse him all the time and work out what his paintings mean and work out the truth to everything. And he's very resistant to that because he doesn't want to be boxed, but also because he feels, I'm not that complicated. Just let me be. And I thought about that a lot, the sense of wanting to pin something down, wanting to define something and make it settled and fixed. And that's often, I think, because we want to hold on to it and we miss it if it's gone. And part of what you're saying about the conversation, I think part of writing Testament was trying to have a conversation with George and being aware that I was attempting to recover him and that I never would be able to.
Yeah.
So it was always going to be a one-sided conversation.
I think that's really interesting, because it's like, to just be aware of, like, yes, everything I'm doing is about piecing someone back together, but I'm fully aware I do not have all the jigsaw pieces.
Yes.
I will never do this.
Yes.
That's why I'm doing it.
Yes.
Exactly. Like, because it's like being with them somehow.
Yes.
It's like remembering, or some
Yeah, and it
weird
was a way to
you.
Feel like I could have some bearings. Yeah. Because I felt so lost. And I remember there was one afternoon, I tried to, he's in a few James Bond films, and I tried to watch one of the films he's in.
Wow.
A few weeks after he died. And as soon as he came on the screen, I turned it off.
Yeah.
And just started howling with tears. Yeah. And the people around me were trying to comfort me. And I didn't know how to explain to them. It's just that this loss has made me feel like I am so lost that I feel like I'm not in charge of my mind anymore.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect it. And I didn't know what to do about it.
And this was, I'm guessing, like your first big grief then.
Yeah. So because my granny Louie had died a few months earlier, but there was, I think, a few differences. She had been ill in a different way. So she had had Alzheimer's for a long time.
Right.
So the granny Louie that I knew had in some ways been gone for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
But also I wasn't directly involved in almost like the cleanup after the death.
Right.
Her son, who's my step uncle or something.
Right, yeah.
He kind of did some of that stuff, but I wasn't as directly involved. Whereas when George died, I was helping box up his books and go through his computer and do we want these files anymore? And, you know, what should we do with these photographs? And all of those, the strange practicalities of death.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be involved in it in that way. But I think it also, I was dismantling somebody's life because he was never going to come back and pick it up again.
Yeah.
I also then started to research the Holocaust for my novel because my grandmother on the other side of the family who's still living, who's a Holocaust survivor,
right.
She at that time started to tell me her childhood memories for the first time ever. So that's where the sort of the research came from for the novel, although it's not her life because that's hers to tell. Mm. It sort of grew from those seeds. But it meant that I was, and I'm sure I did this unconsciously for a reason, but it meant that I was reading about death and writing about death on a mass scale all the time.
Mm.
And missing George. And so I just was thinking about death all the time.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah. And I remember saying to somebody, I don't know, it's just, I just can't stop thinking about death. And they said, oh, why do you think that is? But I was like, oh, I see.
I guess reading about the Holocaust does. It brings it up a little, you know, it's kind
and
of
then
present.
It was just everywhere. Like, my relief at the time was watching Star Trek. I thought, okay, I'll go to a utopia.
Yeah.
That's got to cheer me up.
Yeah.
No. Then it was
Star Trek is pretty, it's basically about what's happening now.
Yes.
That's always what it's about.
And there's a particular, three or four episodes in Star Trek Voyager where there are these aliens who just dress up as SS officers. So I'm watching Star Trek for some relief, you know, taking a break from the writing. Okay, I'll watch some nice utopia. No, it's just everywhere.
Can I recommend comedy to you, Kim?
Yes.
Like, that is literally all I will watch. I mean, like, Hannah Gadsby's Nanette is not a cheer-upper, but it is amazing.
Amazing.
But it's cheer-up in a different way. But, like, The American Office, my friend,
mm-hmm.
It is just so funny and silly. You need, like, pure laughter when this is what you're dealing with.
Yes.
Because you just need your brain to be like, nothing is happening for 30 minutes.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Yeah. So how did you find that the writing the book in, like you keep saying, like you felt lost. Did the writing the book somehow you found yourself without using a terrible cliche?
In many ways, yes.
Yeah.
Found myself or at least reconciled with the fact that some things couldn't be found again and would always be altered.
Yeah, I guess that's it, isn't it? Because you feel lost, but it's not that you're lost, it's that everything has changed.
Yes.
And that you're now different.
Yes.
So you're grieving, my therapist always says, like, you're grieving the old you that didn't know about this.
Yeah.
But if that feels like as if you've had a new haircut and you're like, I look really different. Like, what's happened? I don't know this person. And so you're just so obsessed with, I don't know this person, rather than going, this is who you are now.
Yes. And people kind of, that thing of, time heals all wounds. Mm. Maybe there's truth to that, I don't know, but
I don't think so. It doesn't seem to be.
No.
People in their 80s aren't like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
All the time, just, and it went away. Everything just went. Yeah.
But how I sort of turned that into, because people would say it to me, how I turned it, I think they were worried about me, because evidently I was going off a bit into my own world. The way I thought about it that could be helpful was, okay, well, you have this wound and it feels gaping and debilitating, like you can't even get up. And then slowly it will scar over.
Yeah.
And then you're a new you with scars, and scars can be uncomfortable and ache and itch, and you still notice them. And sometimes you might forget that they're there, but then you catch them in a mirror and realise, oh God, I do look very different now. I am very different now.
Yeah.
And that idea has helped me in a sense, because I feel like it's not that there's something wrong with me.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just I've got these scars now. I'm different now.
Yeah. I think it's so hard because you're, especially when it's a big loss, you're grieving for the loss of a person, and then you slowly realise, oh, I'm also grieving for myself and my life and everything. And you're like, well, that's fucking a lot of fucking loss right now.
Yes.
I don't want to deal with this. And it's, yeah, it's really, that's why I get really angry about the, get on my high horse, but at the time, like, you know, time heals, or the other one that I've been getting lately, which makes me want to punch people, is, you know, grief is just love with nowhere to go.
What?
Yeah, that's a new one that's memeing its way around to me. Come and apologies on. If you've tweeted it to me. Because I feel like, look, I know where you're coming from. I get it. But to me, what makes me angry is whenever somebody tries to make something binary.
Mm.
So it's like, grief is X, yes, and X equals Y. It's time. You just need time over feelings, and you'll eventually forget these things. It's like, it's such a mess. Grief is a fucking mess. And when you look at someone's house you have to sort out and you think, Jesus Christ, this is a mess.
Mm.
That's what grief is. That's why people find the house hard, because it's the same as their own emotions. It's like, I've got all these fucking books. I've got all these fucking emotions to deal with. Like, this is, and every bit of you is like, everything's too much. I want it all to go away.
Yes.
I want to close the door on it. Including my emotions.
Absolutely. And get away from myself somehow. Yeah. And that was something that writing can help with, because you can put yourself into other worlds, other characters. But it was something I really struggled with. I remember it sort of being really the only time in my life where I wished that I was somebody who, like, I don't know, took hallucinogenics and went to raves or something. Yeah. I was like, why didn't I had my punk phase too early. When I was about 10, I shaved my head, had my punk phase. Right. Should have had that later.
I don't, because I was... You know, like I said, my friends were taking drugs and drinking, and I was like, oh, I think there's another me that would drink herself into oblivion.
Mm.
But
that was what I wanted to be able to do.
I just couldn't.
But failed.
Yeah. Mm. And also, I don't know. I think everyone deals with it differently. But my thing was like, how, as if alcohol would make this go away.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I wanted to be able to do it in the sense of I wanted to be able to escape my body and my mind. But I knew that wouldn't help.
I think the thing is, like, when I would see people doing it, or, you know, as I got older and I'd see people... Not that everyone who's drinking has a drinking problem, but, like, you can sometimes see your friend using it unhelpfully.
Mm.
And I think, does that work?
Because
this never goes away.
Yes.
This pain is, like, I carry it with me. So, really, you're telling me that if I take this pill or drink that much wine, it'll go away? Because every time I try, it's louder.
Yes.
It's just louder.
Yes.
Because I'm like, oh, why am I so sour? It's that.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas, down come the walls.
Yeah. Whereas, again, you know, we all deal with it differently. I very much am a sort of high-functioning workaholic. So, I was like, oh, great. If I work constantly, I can't think of anything sad because I'm too tired.
Absolutely. And that's what I was doing, I think, by staying on the MA.
I was like, it's fine.
I'll just keep going.
Yeah.
And I wish that somebody there had caught me and said, maybe stop. My family were, but you know, you can rationalize your family. You can be like, no, they're just concerned for me.
Yeah.
But then in retrospect, you think, well, yes.
Yeah, they were concerned for
you. Why didn't you listen to that?
They're just worried about me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so true. You're like, they're just worried. And you're like, why are they worried?
Probably for a reason.
Because I'm acting crazy. Yes. Why are you acting crazy? Because I'm deeply unhappy. Anyway, I don't know why everyone's looking at me.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm doing well.
Yeah. And I'm sick. How much? I'm smiling.
Yeah.
Yeah, too much. It's weird. All right, I'll do a bit less. I'll act like a human. Yeah, it's so... It's funny, though, because I always think that with, like, I wish... Like you said, if your family couldn't stop you, if a teacher had said to you...
It made no difference.
Yeah, because I say that, oh, like, if someone at school had done this or done this, I think, I don't know if I'd have listened. I don't know. Because I also think there's something about, like you said, like, filling your brain with something.
Yes.
So the MA allowed you to just be distracted. And even though... And I also think we don't live in a society where it's possible.
Mm.
Like, because we don't talk about it and it's not given the space that I think it deserves.
Yeah.
If you had said to people, I'm going to take a year off to really grieve, they'd be like, what?
Yeah. Is that healthy?
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Kim's having a breakdown.
Yeah, exactly.
And then my other obsession that... when you have a baby and people are like, take some time, relax, get you, your world has changed, you know, this is a really big thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are, you know, I went back to work very quickly because I'm a high functioning workaholic. but I think with deaf, it's like you said, people only give you so much space.
Mm.
Did you find as well, because it was your grandpa? that yeah. people were a bit like, yeah, she's still
yeah,
sad.
Yeah, yeah. I think people who didn't know me that well,
yeah,
they gave me a few weeks where they were really nice, yeah. and then they were like, okay, why is she still?
Yeah,
like why is she not coming out and yeah. partying? And you know, why is she not being as sociable as she seemed to be before? And what's
yeah,
going on here?
Yeah.
I remember one person saying to me, you know, one of those observations where you feel like could have lived without that. One person who I'd met on the MA saying to me, when I first met you, you were really sociable and you were coming out all the time, and now you just don't. It's just a silence. Thanks.
Do you think, again, it's like, do you think there might be a reason?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think,
thanks for noticing.
What do you think the reason could be? Because
yeah.
I think I've told you that I'm someone yeah. I love died.
Yeah, but because, you know, not everybody's that close with their
no,
grandparents.
I know.
And relationships are always different and context matters. So some people, yeah. I think, don't really get what it can mean.
I think we're all very guilty of, and it's a totally sort of rational human thing to do, of being like, oh, well, my relationship is like this,
mm.
therefore I'm imagining yours is exactly the same.
Yes.
Yeah, and my grandpa was this like huge figure in my mm. life, very dominant, like more dominant than my dad in some ways, which, mm. you know, might be some of the problems.
Mm.
And he died 6 months after my dad. So I think, wow. in a way, I remember growing up thinking, God, what will I do if Grandpa ever goes?
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, I don't, okay, gone.
Yes.
My dad just died. So when yes. he died, it was like, okay, it was just one more thing on the pile. And I
yes.
almost didn't, I almost, yeah, couldn't quite process. They kind of got mixed in together because mm. it was like, well.
And so close to each other as well.
Yeah, and they were very close, literally.
Mm. Yeah.
And then close in death. And yeah, my grandpa basically said, I mean, this is my memory of it, he was like, yeah, I don't want to be here, so he mm. died.
Yeah.
Didn't kill himself, he just literally was like, no, my yeah. body's not having it, thank you very much, yeah. without my son here.
I think in some ways George was similar because he'd been ill for so long.
Yeah.
My granny Louie was ill too, they were in homes, and then when she died he couldn't come to the funeral because he couldn't get out of bed, and I think that was such a heartbreak.
Yeah.
Additionally, you know, that he couldn't go and perform the thing he was supposed to perform.
Yeah.
And he died a few months after her, and I do think there was a sense of release and a sense of following her. I mean, I'm very aware that after he died, I was obsessively looking for signs
yeah,
all the time.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But
hello,
yes.
I'm here. If you guys want to like
yeah,
say
exactly,
anything,
exactly.
Yeah, silence.
Yeah. But I remember going for this beautiful walk with my mum on Salisbury Plains, which is where they had lived and where George and Louis had loved walking. And we were walking across this kind of valley, and we saw a deer run out of the woods and down the field and stop and then stare and look at us and then keep running. And then another deer appeared from the woods, ran down and followed. And it was an amazing moment because it felt like that was what had happened, that George had followed.
And why not?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The thing is,
like,
if you want to be... I'm not religious myself.
Mm.
I can imagine that there's great comfort in being
yes.
religious.
Oh, lovely.
Because you're perhaps provided with a narrative structure
yeah.
to compute what's happening.
Mm.
In some ways, my writing, I was trying to give myself a narrative structure around something that was uncontainable and without narrative. But also looking for signs like that and always, you know, if the smallest thing happened, oh, George would have said this, or George would, oh, that's so funny because, and you know, the thing with my agency and then my publisher feeling like, oh, it's George saying something.
Yeah.
If it is or it isn't, in a way, it doesn't matter. Because it
yeah,
is
I mean,
part
it's
of
like,
my conversation
yeah,
with him.
Yeah, does it work? Is
yeah.
it making you feel better? Great.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Then watch another episode of The American Office.
Yes.
Fine. I think that's so interesting. I've talked about that a lot in the show, of like the obsession with narrative. And I think writers, you know, whether it's, you know, comedians or performers mm. or novel writers, it's trying to control the uncontrollable.
Yes.
And I think... I'm always trying to put a narrative because my ending was taken away.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you're just constantly being, it's like, it's so weird, isn't it? It's like someone's telling you a story and the ending disappeared. So you're like, okay, guys, I got it.
Yeah.
I'm going to, okay, I got the character. I think I
yes.
know what happens.
Yes, yes, yes.
This is what happens.
I can finish this script.
I can finish the script.
Yeah.
yeah. And I think it's because, like you said, it's that sense of chaos
mm.
that we spend so much of our everyday life
mm.
ignoring the chaos.
Yes.
And being like,
and
no,
just carrying on.
Life is fine. We get up at this time, we go to bed at this
yes.
time, we eat these things, and actually everything's in control.
Yes.
Whereas if you like lift the carpet even a slight bit, you're like, shit, there's
mm.
it's messy down here.
Yes.
It's really bad. Guys.
Absolutely.
We should do something about that.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, death is such Yeah, it's like, oh, this sounds so like lame. I'm so bad. I'm so great at shit metaphors. But it's like, death is like, it does tap you on the shoulder and be like, this is what's actually happening.
Yes.
Your
yes.
whole life has been building up to your death.
Yeah.
But you've been acting like your lunch was important.
Yes.
And you were like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
What?
Exactly. And I think partly what creating something can do is give you shape and form so that you can point to it and say, look at that chaos.
Yeah.
I was really struck by... On Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe, and he says that in Inuit cultures there was a tradition of walking out from the homes with a stick and walking a really, really long way and then planting the stick to show how great your anger or how great your bereavement or how great your love might be, to show the scale of the emotion. It's here, I plant it here. And I loved that idea because...
That's amazing because, I mean, sometimes I'm so angry I would walk a long way to be like, that's how fucking angry I am.
Yes, you can't even see me anymore.
Five tube stops and I've walked it.
Yes.
Like, oh my, like, yeah, God. I'm in zone six. Exactly. Angry I am going. Exactly. That's amazing. I love it. Like, literally, like, an actual visual metaphor.
Yes, yeah. And I really loved that it gives physicality to the feeling. Yeah. And that's something that writing a book or performing stand-up or painting something can do. It gives physicality to something that otherwise can feel like it's beyond speech, it's beyond tangibility, and it's invisible. And then you make it concrete and you say to people, look, here it is.
Mm.
However broken or not, here's my narrative.
Yeah.
Here's my embodiment of what I'm going through.
And it's so fascinating to me that you're like, I mean, it's great cliches, that out of death comes life, comes something else. And you're right, it is a physical embodiment of your pain, but you've created something new.
Yes.
In without meaning to carry on this process.
Yes. Like, there's a lovely way. So one of the things that happened to me afterwards, you know, I was saying I suddenly was seeing death everywhere.
Yeah.
I would get really upset at moments in action films when mercenaries died.
Same.
Yes.
I weep for them. Yes. They don't like it. They just kill them. They shoot people with no thought.
Exactly. Before, I'd always found action films really, really comforting.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, well, my comfort is Die Hard. I'll put Die Hard on. And then you watch, you know, just the briefest moment when they shoot the mercenary glibly, and there's just
this
moment in the eye, no one cares. And I'd get really upset about, you know, bad guy number four dying.
Yeah.
But I was just kind of seeing it everywhere. And then I was reading one of the Jack Reacher novels by Lee Child. Yeah. Jack Reacher's mother dies. So again, I turned to this for some escape, for some comfort, Child. Yeah. But no, it had to be the one about the mother dying. But there was this line in there which actually... it really struck me, where the mother's ill but refusing treatment, and the mother says to Jack Reacher, I don't want to take treatment because if I die there's more space for somebody else on the planet, and I've had my life, and she kind of talks about it quite mathematically, like, I take up this much space, and then somebody else could have that cubic feet, you know, of my body in the world. And of course it doesn't really work that way, but it made me think about what can replace the person.
Yeah.
Nothing can replace the person themselves, but maybe I could do something that could stand in their footsteps. You know, maybe I can write this book and say to George, here, this is in memory of you, this exists now.
And that is so interesting, because I just think you feel like you've got a hole in the middle of you.
Absolutely.
Like, you feel like there's a literal physical hole.
Absolutely.
And then it is, what do you fill it with? And I think if you can fill it with something that is about creating something new, I'm not talking like having a baby. I mean, like you said, it doesn't, however you want to express yourself, then the space is, like you said, it's not better, but rather than filling it, that's what I always try to tell myself, like, if I fill it with alcohol, it doesn't make the space feels worse.
Yeah,
it's like the alcohol sloshes around in that hole and I feel more empty.
Mm.
Whereas if I fill it with performance or writing, it's like, it's somehow, I don't know, like, it like feeds the hole or something. It just, it's like, it doesn't hurt as much.
Yes.
And I find anything that tries to dampen that pain is makes, to me, much more, feel much worse.
Absolutely. There's that Paul Simon lyric, I can't remember it exactly, but it's about the heart being a window.
Oh, yes.
And he says, everybody sees you're blown apart. And it's like the window's smashed and everybody can see into it.
Oh,
and that's,
I love Paul Simon so much. I really want to know this.
Me too.
Everybody says you're blown apart.
Everybody sees the window.
Everyone sees the window. Oh, God. Okay. People listening are screaming the lyric at us. Yeah, yeah. We'll Google it.
We'll Google it. But that to me so kind of summed it up, because I felt like people could see.
Yes.
They couldn't really, and that often.
But you feel it's like hard, like your greaseproof paper or something.
Yes,
like
yeah. And there is this hole that people could point to and go, wow, look at that. God, that's gaping.
Yeah.
And so it does feel comforting to say, well, yes, it is gaping, but also, like, I can fill it.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be blown apart forever.
Yeah.
In that way.
The other thing you made me think of is that Austin Powers sketch. Have you said, do you remember that? Is it Austin Powers 2? Where they shoot all the guys and then they cut. This made me laugh. So they cut to the woman and it's like, hello? Oh, is this the wife of Henchman 5? Yes. He just died. Johnny, your father's died. And I was like, I cried with laughter at that.
So true.
Because I was like, yes, I feel like Henchman 5 does have a family.
Yes, yes.
And when you have...
Otherwise, where's your henchman? He's probably, you know, it's hard to get a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, there you go. If you've
got limited skills.
Who's obsessed with narrative, you will find a narrative for fucking anything.
Yes.
Absolutely yes. anything.
Yeah, he's been disillusioned with other things in life.
Yeah,
he used to believe, now just do it for money.
He wanted to be henchman 4. He was working up. He thought, maybe one day I can be henchman 1. I don't know. I'm going to just see what happens.
Yeah. And then, no, you're wearing a red shirt, you're cut down.
I mean, I haven't seen it for years, so maybe I shouldn't recommend it, because you know sometimes you watch it and go, oh, it's very misogynistic, I've forgotten. But at the time, I remember really enjoying us. Well, Kim, thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's been really lovely.
About George and Testament, which is available to buy now at all good bookshops, I'm assuming.
Indeed, indeed.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Kim's novel, Testament, is available to buy now in all good bookshops, and you can follow her on Twitter at Kim T. Sherwood. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast, or you can email thegriefcast@gmail.com. If you have been enjoying the show, please do rate and review it on iTunes. It really helps other people find the show. I know we all say that, but it's true. And if you also are enjoying it, you can subscribe so you don't miss an episode as well. Music was provided by the Glue Ensemble, and the show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.